You're listening to Resolution Radio.
ResolutionRDO.com.
You are listening to the Nordic Frontier, the final solution to your podcast problem.
Greetings, comrades. This is Andreas Johansson, and welcome to a special installation of the Nordic Frontier. Tonight, I'm sitting here with yet another man from the other side of the pond, Sonny Thomas from the US of A, and we're going to talk about the man himself, the American situation, and what remedy could be for those brave souls that crossed the ocean for the New World those centuries ago. So, without further ado, I say welcome to the show, Sonny Thomas. How are you?
Ah, thank you very much. Very glad to be on your program. I'm a big fan of yours. Your show has been featured now on my network, the Resolution Radio Network at resolutionrdo.com on Fridays now. And we've had some very good ratings on that as well, because the fact that even though you're focusing on more local situation and what's going on there and current events, overall, your program has a lot of wide appeal because of the fact that the fact that it is in English, the fact that you guys cover a lot of issues that's not just narrow to the Nordic countries, but also just general commentary either on life, music, or what have you. So you do have a lot more mass appeal with your English program. And when people start looking up what Nordfront is, they're probably blown away of the excellent optics that some of the photography that's been taken of your rallies. Some of the excellent, and I say good, propaganda videos that either one of your followers or a fan has been putting together for the Nordic Resistance Movement. There's been some excellent videos overall. I mean, as a videographer myself, I look at some of those videos and go, wow, you know, I first look at the content, I look at the effect, and I look at the reaction that I get. Then I go back and watch it again and look at the mechanics of the video. What filters are they using? What type of editing techniques, et cetera, to give me ideas as well. So I definitely appreciate it not only as a fan of your guys' work, but also at the same time, whomever's putting those videos out does an excellent job really showcasing what you guys do when you march out in public.
Yeah, I really appreciate you saying that. Yeah, we do have a lot of people talented with video and photography. And we're also grateful for all the people donating money to us so that we can keep up with the gear and make really nice-looking things. Because, like you say, they do appeal people to, you know, get inspired and maybe even join the movement. So, but yeah, before getting into other things, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and where you're from?
Well, I was originally born and raised in the Dayton, Ohio area, which is home of many things, most notably the Wright brothers, which put forth their airplane, which they actually flew in North Carolina, but it was designed and built here in the Dayton area. Also, home of NCR, which is the National Cash Register, which was one of the big, big developments as far as engineering for retail back in the late 1800s. And there's a lot of other aspects too the Dayton area also holds as well. We have some famous actors that were born here, as well as some authors and many other individuals that make Dayton home, as well as on the historical map. And of course, nowadays, because of the Wright brothers, we have the Air Force Museum, which also holds for example, a display of the presidential aircraft, which is known as Air Force One later on, of course. But almost all of the Air Force One planes, including the famous one that John Kennedy was on and put back on in a casket in 1963, which is actually 55 years ago, a couple days ago, is now housed at the Air Force Museum there at Wright-Patterson. So there's just some general different things. Plus the fact for marketing purposes, a lot of organizations and companies use Dayton as a testing ground. For example, because we have a pretty good class mixture here, a blue collar, white collar, just good internal things. So, I mean, like if McDonald's wants to try a new sandwich or something, Dayton is often seen as a test market to see how the rest of the United States might actually dig or not dig the sandwich itself. So that we're just a really good testing ground for that type of thing because of the composition of our population. But overall, I was born, obviously, I'm a Nixon baby. I was born in the early 70s. And born and raised in Dayton, Ohio. Of course, I was growing up in the East End, which is in a neighborhood known as Belmont. And it was a good middle-class neighborhood for a long time. And I have a lot of good memories of that time period as well as being raised in the Dayton area. And then by the time high school came around, I had got involved in a radio and TV broadcasting program through the Dayton Public School System. And so by junior year in high school, I got enrolled in this program, and interesting enough, after 2 weeks, I was the only white student in the class, which I thought was pretty interesting at the time. But nevertheless, we had a radio, actual radio station. It was formatted. It was a college formatted high school station, and they covered a wide range of different musical styles. So actually, I was exposed. I had a very eclectic music background myself, but I had gotten exposed more to modern jazz, blues, folk, some of the other alternative rock, and some other different things there as well. So I was able to increase more tastes on my palate and really enjoyed being an air jockey. So I was not only the program director, heavy metal director, but also air host for many different styles and formats. But it really gave me hands-on experience on doing terrestrial radio, and I really appreciated that as much. And so when I graduated and left the program, I was able to follow a lot of the local bands and stuff several years later. There was still a burgeoning music scene in the Dayton area. As a matter of fact, after grunge started to die out, Dayton was seen as the next hotbed for musical talent, and unfortunately there were certain powers that be that strangulated that as fast as they could for whatever reason, but Dayton's always had a pretty good rich history. Well,
what was that music. Kind of? What was the kind of music coming out of Dayton then? That was
all different kinds. I mean, even though by the mid '90s, grunge and industrial was probably the main modern staples. Mm-hmm. You had a lot of other bands that were coming up. I mean, if there's a section of town called the Oregon District, which is on Fifth Street in Dayton. Which used to have like old train tracks for like trolley cars and stuff from back in the day, brick roads and everything else. But there's a whole host of bars and stuff there where they would play all different kinds of music any given night of the week, have open mic nights, whatever. And you could go into like Oregon Express and hear blues rock. You could go into some of the other places like Ned Peppers and you could hear, you know, modern rock, or you could go hear singer-songwriter stuff. It really didn't matter. And then just down the street from there was a place called Canal Street Tavern, which was open for well over 30-some-odd years. We called it the CBGBs of Dayton because it had that type of vibe to it. And any given night, again, you could have all different kinds of music. And Mick Montgomery ran it for a long time, booked most of those acts all himself. And, for example, he had one band that come from Oakland, California called Tempest, which is more Celtic folk rock with oh, God, I forget Leif's last name off the top of my head. But anyway, they would play there like every year and have a pretty good crowd as well. So any given night, you could hear all different kinds of music here in the Dayton area. Unfortunately, except for some of the college formatted radio stations like WYSO or some of the other stations, it was largely ignored. So it never really had a chance to be embraced by commercial radio like WTUE, which was the classic rock station, or the X, which is the modern rock station, for example, all owned by Clear Channel, of course. So a lot of these guys had to eke out an existence by sheer word of mouth, self-promotion, and this is all before the internet really started to get big as far as bands promoting themselves. But some of these bands had very, very large followings and would pack out any given club that they booked at. And that was about the time that I started discovering more of these bands and really started getting into it, buying all of the material, whatever I could get my hands on, getting to know the members of the bands. And then after 9/11, I started learning how to do HTML programming with my GeoCities website through Yahoo and took my radio program to the internet, the HMD Music Resource Guide, and then became very entwined with the local Dayton music scene, doing album reviews, doing interviews, whatever I could to promote some of these bands, and then it just kind of blossomed from there.
Mm. That's really nice. So you had an early interest in music then, and it was metal, heavy metal?
Yeah, metal was probably my favorite. I mean, I listened to a lot of music growing up. My mother doesn't realize just how influential she is with her records that she had. And to her, a lot of it was just pop music that she liked and would go out and buy the records to. But a lot of the groups that she had, I actually had a lot of black-based music. I listened to a lot of Motown that she had. Earth, Wind, and Fire was a big influence for me growing up. Donna Summer, who's the queen of disco, I used to love listening to her records growing up as well. And but she had a lot of pop stuff that she had. She had some Olivia Newton-John. Not so much Fleetwood Mac. I got into them a little bit later. But there was a lot of pop music that was there. I mean, my uncle also listened to a lot of music. Because after my mom and dad got divorced, she went to college, and so my grandpa would oftentimes watch me. So even though she was playing a lot of pop and R&B, disco, and Motown stuff upstairs in her room, downstairs my uncle's room, he played a lot of what I consider classic rock. So I hear a lot of T.U.E., not T.U.E., but I hear a lot of Pink Floyd, Kiss, Thin Lizzy, Allman Brothers. So I got the complete opposite ends of the spectrum. And me being a Scorpio, that actually is right up my alley, because when it comes to musical taste, I have a tendency to go to opposite ends of the spectrum. So I can hear a lot of really cool dance, disco, and techno stuff, but I can also really appreciate a lot of good hard rock, heavy metal, and experimental stuff. And so I was fortunate to have both ends of the spectrum inside my grandfather's house growing up when I was like between 5 and 10 years old.
This sounds really nice. Yeah, I've been getting into some 90s grunge and I've been listening to Pantera lately. Is that a band you're familiar with?
Yeah, I really didn't get their first album too much. Their second album, Vulgar Display of Power, I thought was pretty solid. But there's some good stuff. But, you know, when grunge was coming out, I was still big into hair metal. Mm-hmm. So some of the bands had to kind of had to modify themselves a little bit, like Metallica with the Black Album went for more of a Johnny Cash straight black look, even though the album was very well mixed and recorded. But you know, like Def Leppard still had a pretty good comeback after almost 5 years since Hysteria, plus losing Steve Clark. Got Vivian Campbell, who was also in a new wave of British heavy metal band that they were associated with back in the day. And that's another era of music I really enjoy as well, is new wave of British heavy metal, which kick-started around 78, 79, and peaked around 82. But there was a lot of good talent that came out of there. And the only three bands that actually survived that were Def Leppard, Iron Maiden, and Venom, which obviously some of those are all, you know, household names. Yeah. But a lot of the other bands that just weren't, I mean, even Diamond Head had some pretty good stuff, which was Lars Ulrich's, you know, favorite band. But there's a lot of good stuff that's out there. And I remember Lars saying something about the fact that when he's talking about the new wave of British heavy metal, he's like, you know, it was trending at the time back in the early 80s that you would go out and try to find the most obscure band you could get your hands on and really get into them and spread the music by word of mouth. But as soon as everybody else started to get into them, like, yeah, that is a good band, boom, all of a sudden they've sold out because more people know about them now. So it was an interesting phenomenon that you could do that with music. And then when people start going, yeah, that is good stuff. Oh, you guys sold out. How does that work?
Yeah. Yeah. The reason why I got into Pantera lately was because I was reminded of this clip of Phil Anselmo. He was doing his White Pride speech live on stage. Are you familiar with that clip?
Yeah, was that the one where he did a Roman salute and people started to give him hell about it?
Yeah, I don't know if he did the salute. I didn't see that. But he goes on about how You know, in the 90s, the hip-hop was poisoning all the youth, and all these black people were making shit music, and everyone was worshipping them. And then he was saying that, you know, the black people, they walk around with a shirt saying that something about black people being great, and that it's a black thing. That's what he was saying. It's a black thing. But he said, maybe tonight, and then for that gig then, maybe tonight is a white thing. And then everyone cheered. And he said that people should have pride in who they are. They should wake up in the morning and look at themselves in the mirror and be proud to be white and things like that. And I believe they had to eat that up later on. But yeah, it was just interesting that they had that. So I started listening to the band. I remember listening to it when I was younger, and I didn't really get into it. But I think it's pretty good. And I think it's... you know, not unique for the time, but it's very grungy metal, and they call it power metal. Like, it was a new sound that came out of the grunge and the metal, and it they started out as a heavy metal band in the 80s, and then they kind of gradually became what it was. And then they had the very dramatic finish with the band, where they broke up and the lead guitarist was shot on stage. So a lot of drama. Very short career for the guys.
Yes, that actually happened here in Ohio. It was a club in Columbus called Al Rosa Villa. And I actually, I didn't go to that gig. Someone had mentioned about maybe going up there, and I said I wasn't really interested in it. I just wasn't a big Pantera fan, even though he was doing a side project. But I do know people that were there, and they recounted what they saw, and it was absolutely pretty terrible what happened. Interesting enough, though, is that a couple of years later I had seen Overkill up there, which is a thrash metal band from the 80s, and a couple of the bands, a lot of times when they have a headline like that, they'll have a lot of local bands as openers, and they sell tickets so they can help pay for the headliner, and then the band makes their money back by selling the tickets to their fans. And my buddy and I went up there, and it wasn't quite a sold out show, but it was pretty well packed. But it wasn't until 2007 when Winger had reunited, and it was their first sold-out show at Al Rosa Villa after Dimebag's murder. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was pretty telling, because as much as Winger had caught a lot of flack, especially because of Metallica and their documentary video, they'd have pictures of Kip Winger up in their studio, and they'd throw darts at him and stuff, you know. Winger's still a very accomplished band of musicians, and they still pack out places. I just saw them last week in Lima, Ohio, with Firehouse. And it wasn't totally sold out, but I guarantee you the people came to see Winger. Firehouse was just a bonus. Nothing against Firehouse, they're a solid band, but they came to see Winger. Mm-hmm. And so it shows that some of these bands from that time period still have a good draw, and they still have very respectable album sales, and people go see them. I mean, I look at some of the interviews when Winger tours over in Europe, and just the huge fan base in some of these things is actually incredible. So, again, I think some bands just – they may be part of a certain era, and other bands, they're good enough that they just have a solid fan base that follows them regardless. And I think that's really says a lot about their music. I mean, to me, a true testament of an artist's music is how well it holds up after they're gone. Mm. I mean – I remember when Elvis died, I didn't really think nothing of it because I was still pretty young. But several years later, I got the Elvis number ones, 30 number one hits or whatever. And I listened to it. I really appreciated his music more as I got older. And not only that, but when I started reading more on him, how much of the recording techniques of the time, they didn't do multi-tracking, they did everything in takes. Elvis was an absolute perfectionist. And so he wanted to make sure it was sounded right. And if it took 50 some odd takes to get the right one he wanted, then that's what he did. I mean, for example, the Jailhouse Rock, he actually used take number 2, even though he recorded it like 50 some odd times. And the only reason why he picked take 2 was because he said Scotty Moore's guitar solo on that take was so phenomenal, even though he thought the drums were substandard. He didn't think his voice was totally up to par like it was in some of the other takes. But he said Scotty Moore's guitar solo on that was never duplicated again live or in studio ever again. And so it was interesting enough that he chose take 2 to be the final print because of the fact that Scotty Moore's guitar solo was just completely spot on. He captured something organic at the time. And he just kind of put the other stuff aside because he figured, wow, this is the version we want. And, of course, Beatles did a lot of innovating in their recordings and their albums. And if you're a late listener to the Beatles like I was, it's really good to listen to an artist in order of their releases because of the fact that you can really appreciate the artistry and their growth as a musician, songwriter, whatever, as you listen to the newer albums because you can hear the artist grow. And I think that's really good for someone like the Beatles because each record does slightly improve upon the previous one, and it makes you appreciate the artistry even more.
Mm. Yeah, that's definitely something to it. So you've been into music for a long time, and you appreciate the old classics. So what do you say about modern music? Do you have any bands that are currently, you know, up and coming or maybe just around that you really enjoy?
Lately, I've been getting into a lot of the RAC stuff, which is Rock Against Communism, or also known as White Rock or White Power Rock. Yeah. My biggest beef with a lot of those artists, and a lot of them have been recording for 30 years, is the recording techniques are very terrible. And it's not necessarily the recording as it is the mixing. Because I know early on, a lot of bands I work with, a lot of them had really good potential, had good songs, but the mix was always terrible. So it sounded like a basement tape. And if it sounds like a basement tape, nobody wants to play it on radio. No. So I've seen some bands come out with some really great mixing. I mean, I still think Metallica's Black album is one of the best mixed commercial albums I've ever heard. Another good example of right out of the box, so you knew you had a powerful entry, is the first Foo Fighters album. You know, Dave Grohl coming off the disintegration of Nirvana, come out with the first Foo Fighters album. From the get-go, this thing was completely in your face, high energy, just like, wow, dude, am I actually listening to this? I mean, it's some really good stuff right off the box. And you realize that Dave Grohl was really the true talent of the band that was being held back just being the drummer. Nothing against Kurt Cobain. I've never seen a band completely destroy and save pop music at the same time. And Nirvana was that. I mean, you talk about Sacrificial Lamb. He totally he went back to punk basics, which basically said nothing is sacred, and then also kind of gave it a refresh sound to it, this, that, and the other. But really, Nirvana is not Nevermind. Really, Nirvana is In Utero. That is Nirvana. What you hear in that sound is really what the band is, and as opposed to the more commercial sounds of Nevermind.
Yeah, it's a bit more chaotic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's and it's crazy. More in your face. But again, it's a very good mix. You got to look at who the producer was at the time. And it still has some bombastic sounds in your face, good stuff. I mean, you know, like Scentless Apprentice and Milk It and some of those other tracks in between really showcase the raw sound of Nirvana. And I think they oftentimes go unnoticed until, again, very short catalog. He blows his head off. That's the end of Nirvana. But, you know, there's a lot of good bands out there. Me personally, I love it when a band's been around for a while because when I get into them and I realize, wow, they've got more than just one or two releases, it's more of a treasure trove for me.
So yeah, definitely.
Whether it's a band like Kiss, Thin Lizzy, or even Pink Floyd, they've got plenty of albums to listen to that you can really go in and feel like you're getting your money's worth when you start buying their albums.
Yeah, and it's true. So switching it up a little bit, I wanted to ask you about the demographic situation where you're from over there in Ohio. How's it looking over there? And yeah, what kind of troubles do you have?
There's a lot of different things that are going on. With this past midterm election, you're starting to see things shifting very quickly. Very similar to some of the situations going on there all over Europa with the migrant crisis. Is the fact that when you have a representative government, that your representative should showcase your constituents. That's not always the case because some of these guys get in office and they have a war chest and they're very hard to beat. Even if you throw their voting records in front of them and say, hey, you did this and this and this, it doesn't matter. I still have more money than you and I'll still win. So that's a bit of a problem. That being said, though, you see some upsets where basically someone really does – you know, fall by the wayside, and you got someone who's got some really fresh ideas, who call them for what they are, and they have a chance of getting elected. But like, for example, in Virginia, you had Dave Bratt, who is, an economics teacher, who actually beat Eric Cantor, who was a House Minority Whip at the time, and beat him pretty good in an election race a few years ago, and then just literally got screwed out by literally probably, I mean, we're talking like 4.3 to 4.6, for example, like differences in voting catalogs. I mean, he literally just got blown out by a handful of votes, and he got a question. The demographic in which he's at, which I do believe is near D.C. there in Virginia, is A, how many of those Democrat votes are actually legit? It's almost an open joke over here that if it's a closer election, don't worry, we do a recount and we'll get the votes. Or, hey, wait a minute, there's a box of votes here in a car trunk somewhere. Yeah. I mean, it's an open joke now that the Democrat will always outbeat the Republican in a recount. And so I think the situation in Florida with the senatorial race between Governor Scott and Bill Nelson was a prime testament of that. The race for governor of Georgia between the black candidate and the white candidate, she would not concede because she was probably told, we will get the votes for you. I think that's probably why she just refused to concede. And plus the fact that she's got a $200,000 debt over her head, she's probably hoping that winning the governorship would help pay her debt off. So I would ask, who owns the debt? Because you know how it is with mobsters. But other ones too, like what happened in Arizona, every time they go to recount, the margin would shrink more and more, and eventually the Democrat won. Which it's interesting in Maricopa County, which voted for Sheriff Arpaio for a number of years. All of a sudden, Soros puts a bunch of money in, Arpaio loses the previous election. But not only that, but the Democrat won because of votes in Maricopa County, which I do believe Phoenix is a fairly blue city. So it shows you some of the corruption that's going on within some of these states and cities, and to the point where the Democrats are outright becoming lawless because of the fact that they're bringing people in and stuffing them into white enclaves. And they're trying to use Section 8 vouchers to force colored families into white neighborhoods, which two things happen, Andreas, is the fact that it brings down the housing values tremendously with each new black family you put in the neighborhood. And again, some of those may be good folks, but this is just an economic fact. You start putting black families in white neighborhoods, the housing values go down. And then eventually you get enough minorities in there, they start putting forth minority candidates, and they use this white guilt that if you don't vote for the minority candidate, you must be a racist.
Yeah. Yeah, we're experiencing that problem now. Sweden is reaching peak diversity, or not really peak, but it's coming to that percentage where they're having a serious influence over politics now. And they have nothing but support from all, you know, all native Swedes and the establishment and things like that. So we're seeing them exercising ethnic politics inside our own country. So it's very exciting times. And I believe that, you know, black people as well, they like Afro-Americans, when they get a certain percentage in a neighborhood, they will tend to stay to themselves. When they reach a certain number, you know, because it's an ethnic reality.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a preacher in Dallas. I think his name is Sale Bryant. And I was listening to him on Alex Jones a while back, and he was talking about how the blacks are much better off in the 1950s than they were in the 60s.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that they had to depend on themselves. They had to have tight-knit communities to be able to get things done. They knew some of the white folks that they could count on to help get a little extra leg up if necessary. And at the same point, they have obviously centered around the family and church. When the 60s came and the Great Society programs was pushed by Lyndon Johnson, the family began to fall apart. So within a decade, the illegitimacy rate went through the roof. They replaced the father with the government tit. And at the same time, you start having all the chaos going on there in the 60s. And it's just like absolutely insane, but it was all completely orchestrated because he had factions that came over here from Germany, which was the Frankfurt School. And as soon as Hitler had come into power, he was getting rid of all the Marxists that he can get his hands on out of Germany. Mm. And in the process, they came to New York. And, of course, they immediately attacked the damn host that they basically latched onto. And within 30 years with guys like Mancuso, had written treatises that basically helped kickstart the counterculture in the 1960s. But I honestly believe, I think America's innocence died on November 22nd, 1963, when Kennedy was assassinated. Because whatever this Camelot vision was, even if it was a euphoria, was completely dissipated like phantoms in the morning night. Because once Kennedy was taken out and those ideals went with him, and Johnson had a pretty harsh reality and then got us involved in Vietnam tenfold, which we never should have been in the first place, America changed very quickly within a matter of a couple of years. And it wasn't for the better. And when Kennedy helped when Teddy Kennedy helped push the Immigration Acts in 1965, which began to open the floodgates into America, it's only taken half a century, but now we're seeing the full effects of that disastrous legislation.
Yeah, definitely. And when you're talking about the blacks having it better, it's true, and it's reflected in South Africa as well, because it was a hot potato in both places at the time. The apartheid and just having places for themselves, you know. It's so horrible for white and black people to have different faucets that they drink water from, you know. But the separation was good for them, and the black societies, they were kind of imitating white civility, but still making it, you know. Being separate, they had to stand on their own feet.
And well, here's an interesting observation, is the fact that I flipped between private schools and public schools growing up during my elementary years. Mm. And when I had to go to public school and eventually start forced to ride a bus, and they'd ship us clear across town to the black side of Dayton. West side's pretty much all black. What was interesting to me is I sat there, even as a little kid, and I didn't understand politics, but I sat there and realized, you know, I was never raised to be racist at all. But at the same time, you get with these people, and they're so alien. They're so different than you. Hmm. And back in the 80s, the big thing was Jerry curls with that hairstyle the blacks would wear. And I still have bad memories of every time I get on a bus with these black kids, they had this damn Jerry curl grease in their hair, and they'd wear like these shower caps. And I remember the smell of this damn stuff. And every time you go to grab onto the seat of the school bus to pull yourself up to get up into the aisleway to walk out, you almost had nothing to grab onto because the tops of the damn bus seats were always greasy with this nasty shit. Uh-huh. And the smell, and you're just kind of like, wow, man. It's like, you know, I don't want to hate these people, but goddamn, they are really different than us, and I'm not saying for the better. I mean, no, even that's the way they talk, the way they act, the way they dress, I mean, you're just kind of like, man, they are so below us. And a lot of us aren't taught to think that way. But if you can count one and one makes two, then you can look at this and say, man, these people are not like you. You know what I'm saying? I mean, seriously, they are a totally different species of people.
Yes, and but it's just kind of like, it's wow. It's enough to say that, you know, we just want our own thing. We want to run our own thing, and we want to live among ourselves so that we can have the society that we choose to shape, you know, instead of their interference. And they can have their own buses where they can be greasy. It's fine.
Where they can be greasy?
Yeah, for sure. So
well, it's like when you were talking, we were talking earlier when I was the only white student in my radio and TV class. Again, it was all the rest of the kids were black. Hmm. But, you know, it's interesting because of the fact that some of them have stereotypes of whites, which is interesting. I remember one young, I remember a black guy. He was kind of short in stature, but apparently he was, you know, a bit of a ladies' man, so to speak. But anyway, I remember him asking me one day. He just turned around and go, "Hey, Sonny, man, I got a question to ask you. What's that?" Now, this might be a little X-rated, but you know, you can always edit it out later. Yeah, but sure. I remember him asking me. He goes, "Man, I just wanted to ask you something, man." I was like, "Well, what's that?" He's like, "Is it true that white guys eat pussy?" I was like, "Well, yeah, don't you?" And you just kind of like, no, I've never tried it, man. I don't, you know, because it's in black culture, it's generally looked down upon for men to perform cunnilingus on women. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, wow, dude, you know what you're missing, dude. I mean, it shows you how selfish you are. Yeah, you want a chick to do it to you, which you won't reciprocate. And you're kind of losing a lot of value, what it's like to have a woman with you. Because let me tell you what, when you take care of a woman and you've unleashed her, dude, all you got to do is lay back and enjoy the ride. Because I tell you what, it is 10 times better. Let me tell you what. That being said, I gave him just some basic tips on how to do it. And I looked at him and said, hey, you see your buddy Alan over here, who's also a black guy? He goes, yeah. I said, you notice all the chicks around him at his locker between classes? He's like, yeah. He's like, he goes downtown, dude. Really? Yeah. That's why he's got those chicks around? Exactly, dude. So it was a culture shock for them to realize that not only does one of their brothers do this, but obviously it's quite popular. And yeah. So it was a bit of a culture shock for him. And so he told me about a week or so later that one of the girls he was with, he says, I don't know exactly if I really am I into it or not, but I definitely got a reaction from her. I'm like, dude, all you got to do is do the alphabet with your tongue and you're good. He's like, really? He's like, yeah, dude, that's how you start. And I was just kind of blowing him off, but apparently that strategy worked for him. And so it upped his game a bit. So he was almost in the same league as his buddy over there. But just go to show you that some of the culture norms, even you watch shows like The Sopranos, that it's kind of tongue-in-cheek that you don't talk about doing that type of stuff, even if it's with your woman, because of the fact that it's seen as a submission to women to go down and please them in that particular way, which is like, wow, dude. I mean, any guy who doesn't take the time to learn how to do that is really missing out because, you know, what they say, a happy wife, happy life. Well, if she's totally satisfied at home, she's sure as hell not going to go looking somewhere else. And so that's one of the things I think when it comes to relationships with a man and a woman, when you really have that deep intimacy together, it really strengthens the bonds a little bit because of the fact that I personally love a good dirty joke and I love tongue-in-cheek stuff. So I'm able to kind of poke my woman in the ribs with kind of like, hey, baby, you know, yada, yada, yada. Yeah, oh yeah, wait till we get home. You know, you have that communication, that interlanguage with each other to just kind of look each other across the room and says, oh yeah, when we get home, I mean, you don't have to say a word. You could just look at each other and communicate, oh yeah, we're getting down tonight, baby. And I think some of that is lost in this political correct world these days because now it's like if she's not the person you're with, to even be able to try to express your interest with a woman, say, hey, I really dig you. I'd like to go out with you sometime. Are you trying to take me on a date, you chauvinist pig, you son of a bitch?
It's a hashtag saying, me too.
Like Woody Woodpecker with the board smacking the face going, fresh, like in a cartoon. You're just kind of like, God damn. And then you wonder why the white race is dying out is because of the fact that men are almost taught to be afraid to approach a woman now. Because of the fact that, oh, my God, did you even look at her? Oh, my God, did you just do elevator eyes on me, you chauvinist pig? Whoa.
Yeah, and it doesn't make it better that we now have consensual contracts in Sweden that we have to sign that, officially now, it's not okay to have sex with a woman unless she says explicitly yes. So you can't have intercourse with her if she's just silent and enjoying it. She has to say yes. And each time you make a new advance, like, I don't know, change position or do something new, she has to express consent when you do it. And I think the man has to express consent as well, both. It's mutual. So that doesn't make it easier for, you know, spontaneous relationships to happen between white people.
Well, not that, but what does that do? That puts a complete wedge between you and another person.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the social engineers have done a fantastic job dividing us, not only amongst class, sex, and other economic aspects, whatever they can do to divide this, they've done a fantastic job. I mean, I've noticed probably since World War II that one of the reasons why the white population is really diminished is the fact that anything is seen as procreation is seen as a Nazi ideology now, because the fact that you actually want to have children, more than one or two, is considered frowned upon, that you are bringing too many mouths to feed in the world, which is interesting because the average white couple, if they're together, maybe has 1.2 children. How in the hell do you have a 0.2 child, right? Mm-hmm. But yet a black person on average has 3 to 4 children. A Hispanic person has at least 4 to 5 children, and Muslims on average have 4 to 8 children per female. Female. But yet we're looked upon as, in this Judeo-Christian BS, that you should only have one woman, be married to one woman, and this, that, and the other, and monogamy, and blah, 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 blah. With that being said, they make it economically unfeasible to have a decent-sized family, because of the fact that if you're not a minority status, you don't get any type of handouts from the government. If you're white, and especially if you're a fairly attractive female, they frown upon you asking for assistance unless you're going to vote for the levies and stuff. So unless they can turn you into a statistic, you're a hindrance to them.
Mm. All right, so let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the situation in America today. So you have Trump. He's a bit up and down and on, I don't know, crazy wild card, I guess. People call him a Jew shill. Some people still see hope in him. He has put on the yarmulke and kissed the wall, and he's talking about being a nationalist. And so what's your take on what's going on in America and Trump, the whole situation?
Well, what's interesting is, historically, you look at a couple of different things that were happening. If Hitler hadn't become chancellor in January 30th, 1933, Germany would have collapsed by 1935, probably reduced back to city-states, if not a civil war. And then you probably would have had other outside factions who would have probably tried to do even more land grabs, even more deep than the Treaty of Versailles. And so Germany would be a totally different place these days. And, of course, economically, no one ever talks about why the economic miracle of National Socialist Germany happened within 2 years. Nobody ever wants to discuss that, obviously, because the fact that abolition of usury was a main factor.
Yeah.
And not having a gold-backed currency was also another factor. But right off the bat, Judea had already put a boycott on Germany. And so right off the bat, they started to develop a deficit with their new Deutschmark. Over here, we have a similar situation. We were starting to have some serious economic issues after 8 years of the usurper Obama. We were looking at even more of a fallout if we had gotten the evil witch Hillary in. And she's already pre-signed treaties with the UN to start doing small arms bans and many other things. So she's a gun grabber, bigger than shit. And the biggest problem is the fact that her whole economic plan would have completely collapsed our economy within 2 years. And so it's interesting how Republicans always hold Ronald Reagan in such high regard. But when you really look at what Reagan did in 8 years, pales in comparison to what Trump did in 8 months. I mean, just him doing the amount of deregulations, getting us out of the climate accords, throwing out the Pacific Rim deal, all this stuff that he managed to kill right off the bat, has absolutely ramped up the economy very quickly. I've seen it firsthand because of the fact that within my profession, just over a year ago, I was just kind of window shopping to see how the job market was looking. And just due by general job searches and stuff, I didn't see much of an improvement. And this is shortly after that tax bill had been passed. But a year later, it's amazing. Just within my field alone, the average pay rate is between $2 and $4 increase for the same job that I was doing in my profession. And also the fact that there was more opportunities, not just an increase in dollars, but more opportunities to choose from. So I didn't just have a handful of possible jobs I could look at. It reminded me of the early 90s after Reagan and Bush came in and gone, and Clinton had come in but hadn't started to tax people yet. where if you didn't like your job or you got fired, you could quit and or get fired and get a job the next day pretty damn quick, which wasn't like that just a few years ago under either Super Obama, because the fact that if you had a job, you better hang on to it, because since Obamacare was kicking in, it was getting harder to find a job. Even full-time employment was starting to become scarce because some of the rules of Obamacare, anything over 40 hours, they had to force you to take out health insurance. And if you didn't have it anyway, you were forced to pay a penalty tax. So it's absolutely disgusting that something like that could have been passed through, and then the Supreme Court, which was already starting to tilt to the left, accepted that. I mean, how do you have an opinion and a dissenting opinion from the Supreme Court Chief Justice? I mean, it's like, what? How do you write both opinions? And so it's clearly obvious that they own the guy, and they were making sure that they were letting everybody know it. So Trump has done so much in a short amount of time. And do we have some questions about his loyalties? Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I've talked about my shows on all the time is if you grant any favoritism to any nation besides your own, that's the definition of sedition and treason, and you should be hung. And anyone that goes and advocates for Israel, to me, is an absolute enemy of humanity, because of the fact that there's so much discussion about is their claim to their land over there even is totally in dispute of what they're doing to the ethnic Palestinians. Is Palestine an open-air prison? I mean, there's all sorts of things going on, and not to mention hypocrisy. When a kid from Palestine throws a rock at Israel, they throw rockets back and annihilate an entire city block.
Yeah, definitely. And they have been doing some back and forths lately, and I've been watching some of the videos, and it's like it's insane, the inhumanity of these people. It's like, because they talk about the only democracy in the Middle East. I mean, so disgusting, the hypocrisy, because, I mean, they're basically snipering children. They're shooting children that are just walking around. They're arresting children that are on their way home from school and basically putting them in detention camps for a few days and torturing them and then releasing them. And then just yesterday I saw a video where they had shot a little girl, and she was left bleeding on the streets. I think she was already dead by the time they were filming it. But you had a crowd of Palestinians trying to reach her, trying to help her. And then you had the Israeli forces pointing guns at them, making sure that they couldn't reach the girl. And then this guy, this Palestinian guy in a wheelchair, wheels up, and they just kick him over so that he's left on the ground on his hands, you know, skimping around like a monkey. It's, you know, absolutely inhumane, the things that they do. And then they go off and support Israel, you know. Mm-hmm. And sure, that's fine, you know, Jews support Israel, but allow us to hate you. Please.
You're right.
Please allow us to boycott you and, you know, want nothing to do with you, because it's fucking disgusting.
Well, here's one of the things I mentioned before when we talked, is the fact that as far as my political stripe go, I classify myself as a Jeffersonian Republican, which means I'm a classical liberal. As far as economics, I would probably be a Ron Paul Republican, so I believe in the Austrian theory of economics. And also at the same time, but on many social values, I'm a paleo conservative. In other words, I don't believe in race mixing and many other aspects and stuff. I think you should take care of your own. But that being said, don't get me wrong. I believe if you're going to have two people of two different cultures come together and marry and this, that, and the other, it should be, if you really love each other, I mean, go for it. I mean, if you can make it work, that's fine. I've seen a lot of mixed couples that really love each other and they make a great time. But bear in mind that if you have any children, it's going to be really hard on those children down the road. And because none of that, but they never seem to embrace the white side. They only always embrace the minority half side. And even in their dark communities, they're seen as rejects because of the fact that they're half breeds. And so it's not really fair to the children to do that. Now, if you're an older couple, yeah, I still frown upon it. But, you know, obviously, if you're not going to bring children into the mix, again, if you can make it a successful union, you know, more power to you. But that being said, the whole purpose of marriage is to have legitimacy when you procreate and have children. It's no different than royalty doing it. You have to make sure you have legitimacy so when you have prince and princesses that they're legitimate heirs to the throne. So those are some things that are going on now. But you look in England, look at both of those. Look at the you know, the princes with those, both those brides. Meghan Markle, really? I mean, seriously, she's what? Part Jew, part monkey? I mean, seriously, dude, she's like a hybrid species. And it's like they're making a big deal. And it's like, oh, she went down to Australia and with Prince Harry or whatever. And although they were so well received, and look, I said, you know what? If it wasn't for the fact that she can pop out a baby, you wouldn't even know about her. I mean, nobody would give two shits about her. Mm. But at least when Di got married to Charles, there's something special there because of the fact that even though Di was just a commoner, she really was that link to the regular people, and people really gravitated to her. I mean, she was a pretty high class lady for being a cop.
Yeah, I think there's definitely more to that story. I think she had special blood that they wanted, and once they got it, she became a problem because she was a bit too clever, so they had to get rid of her. But you know, I always had my tinfoil hat on, so.
Right, I mean, she obviously wasn't Rh negative, but you know, but we know that the family are vampires. They're originally from Transylvania, so they're not British at all.
Yeah, they're the lizard people. I know.
Crazy stuff.
Yeah, so we're talking about Trump, talking about America. So you have this caravan.
Let me add to what you were asking about before. I think Trump has done a lot in a very good short amount of time. Do I sometimes agree with some of his tactics? Sometimes I raise a question to it, but I'm like, you know what? You also got to take into account that being in that position and having access to information that you and I would not know anything about, it's easy to pass judgment on a guy when he makes a decision. But when he's given A, B, and C and withheld from D, and then you wonder why he makes a bad decision, if – there's certain people within the branch who withhold information from him for whatever reason, and he goes left instead of right. You can't hate the guy because if he's only given so much information to cull from, then that's what he's kind of stuck on. However, if he does have access to information D, he is going to make a proper decision because of the fact that he has to take all those factors into play. So again, it's easier to pass judgment on a guy who's calling the shots when you don't know the factors. It's like, if you, depending on what your job profession is, you've had managers or supervisors or whatever the case may be, and you always have the supervisor who's always a complete prick, you know. It's like, oh, why are you always an asshole, you know, whatever the case may be. But you know what? When you end up getting that position and you start looking at the reports and you start looking how the proverbial shit rolls down, and so obviously you have to have results that happen, you're more likely to appreciate, understand why the supervisor is a prick, because when you start looking at numbers and you're expected to perform at a certain level and you're not able to do that, you understand why the guy is kind of a prick, you know. But that being said, people will always respect a sergeant more than a captain, because the fact a sergeant is in the trenches with you, will roll up the sleeves and get down and do the work with you. If you have a guy that's just sitting up there, essentially a general sitting in back of the army instead of an Alexander leading from the front, you're more likely going to have dissent within the ranks because of the fact that they see you as, oh, you're a carpet walker because you're in the office all the time. You're not out here with us grunts, you know. But when someone's actually out there, all right, cool, he does his administrative duties and he gets out there and he's actually running the presses with you or doing the hard work with you, you have more respect for that foreman, that supervisor, that manager, because of the fact that he's actually in the muck with you. And so you have more loyalty and you have more tendency to let some of his issues slide, because the guy is obviously under pressure, but you know what? He's with you. And so I think that also goes with some of the movements too, because if we see some of these Richard Spencer guys and stuff, they're out there, they're yada, 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 as opposed to guys like Jeff Skoop from National Socialist Movement, who's actually out there on the streets, like he says all the time. You know, if you're not actually out in the streets, man, you're not really, you know, doing much effect for us. It's good to have an intellectual. It's good to have an inspirational guy. It's good to have this, that, and the other. But if you're not actually out there in the boots and braces, as they call it, and walking the streets with them, you're not as effective, because of the fact that you're not willing to take a hit to the head as you were if you're on the other side of the podium.
Yeah, that's true. And yeah, let's talk about that, what could be done in the Americas. So you've had the alt-right rise with Trump. It's been a bit of a divide of lately. Since Charlottesville, I think, there was a divide between the intellectuals and the people that wanted to hit the streets. There was people getting cold feet after the National Guard was called in. I think it was the National Guard that was called in. And it was declared an unlawful assembly, and everyone was basically pushed through the gauntlet of the Antifa, and all shit broke loose. And we've heard nothing, you know, but shit about that since. Like, it was the worst thing that ever happened, like the Holocaust. Even though you have, you know, way worse things happening on a daily basis in places like Chicago.
Yes.
But, yeah. With this situation, with the movements, it has split up, and there's always new ones popping up. Individuals having great ideas, wanting to create their own thing. And we're more of the mindset, and we've discussed that many times on the show, that it needs to be a united front, needs to be one unit that works towards one goal. And that goal needs to be, you know, written down. It needs to be solid so that everyone's on the same page. But it's very hard in America. It's a big country. It's basically half a continent. And it's also demographically complicated from the beginning. From the get-go, it has always been a multicultural country, even though the founding fathers didn't consider black slaves to be citizens. They were still there. They're still around. And they were let loose into the population and has now become a part of the population for hundreds of years. So you're left with that. And then you have South America coming in on a regular basis as well, increasing the folds. So with this democratic situation, it's becoming harder and harder to claim that it's a white country, because it is constantly changing and being browner and browner. And they're also letting in Muslims. They're importing Muslims by the thousands. So, yeah, what kind of solutions do you see for this this mess?
Well, I could tell you, for example, my general observations of the composition of people here in the Dayton area is actually really ratcheted up the last few years. An ex-girlfriend of mine, her daughter was in high school at the time, and even at our alma mater, and she was talking about how there was a huge influx of Russians, but mainly Somalians too. There's a lot of Somalians that were coming in, and which is interesting because at that point, my high school, Belmont, was the only East Side high school left in the Dayton public school system. So we always had a traditional thing where we would never allow the population to be more than 50% black in that particular school district, where all the other places, especially on the west side, could be more than 50% because it's on the west side. So it's interesting how much the people have come in. I mean, we've got areas of the Dayton area where we've had traditionally just real low-class white folk had lived there for a long time, like a street called Xenia Avenue. And all of a sudden, the last probably 10 years, you've seen a huge influx of Hispanics down there, partially because there's a Catholic church that's there. It's been there for, God, 100-some-odd years. And, of course, Hispanics are diehard Catholics. And so the diocese, obviously, there is taking advantage of that because of the fact that people are starting to come in, which means the collection plate's growing, even if it's in small amounts. It's growing. And so they've got – and also at the same time, what they're doing is because it's suppressing the housing values even more on that particular street, they are buying up the housing complexes by the bundle because of the fact that they've now lowered the prices so much that they're able to gobble them up and own all this property. And one of the ways you could tell when you're being colonized is twofold. Is you all of a sudden start seeing a Mexican restaurant or a La Tienda, which is like a Mexican store, start popping up, especially places where previous stores had not done very well. That's your first sign that you just got invaded. Second sign is you start seeing the graffiti in the walls, particular section where I tend to go bicycle riding. There's an apartment complex that my mother used to manage years ago, is now getting a large Hispanic population. You can tell by the graffiti on the bikeways. And this isn't just the janky spray paint stick figure stuff like you see a lot of East Dayton hoods go out and do just to say, oh, you know, Kilroy was here, so, you know, referencing the 1983 Styx album. Mm-hmm. But you see very intricate graffiti or using types of fonts and artistry that you would expect to see in like East L.A. And I actually started filming some of the areas there, and I sent that footage to a gang unit in L.A., and I said, I'm getting the impression there's some hidden messages within some of this graffiti. Can you verify? He says, what do you think? I said, it seems to me there's definitely some hidden messages in there, basically some warnings. He says, you're absolutely right, Mr. Thomas. He said, what you're seeing is just some of the shapes of the fonts. If you look inside the lettering, the inside holes of some of the lettering is said, if you look at this one particular one here, it is a black noose around a white figure. It's saying is that MS-13 or La Mecha or La Raza is going to start killing white folks. That's exactly what the graphics are saying, is they're letting you know that they're taking over your neighborhood. So when they always hear the impression the writing is on the wall, this is exactly what they're referring to.
Yeah.
So they're openly bragging through art, through artistry, that they are taking over your neighborhood. And so as you start to look at the crime statistics in from each neighborhood, sometimes they're skewed depending on who's in a position of authority, but you start seeing that the minorities, the crime rates are starting to grow up even more. And then the city of Dayton started forcing out blacks out of West Dayton by buying up each block and trying to refurbish it. Well, they have no place else to go. So they either start coming into the east side or they're going to North Dayton, which used to be a Polish neighborhood back when my grandfather was growing up. But again, that's very low class rental areas as well. But now they're starting to move into a second tier suburb, which is Kettering, which used to be a lot of white people. And you're starting to see more trash showing up on the streets, more black folks walking up and down the streets all hours of the day and night. That's how they're doing it, is they're using vouchers to start force suppressing these colors into white neighborhoods. And so the white flight continues. So you get in fourth and fifth and sixth tier suburbs of the Dayton area, which are mostly for white folks. But they're trying to push black families into those neighborhoods as well, again, using Section 8 vouchers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what could be done against this, do you think?
It's hard because of the fact that I've inquired about it just here in Springboro. And they've talked about how the fact that if you receive any type of benefits from the county on certain things, that they cannot refuse the vouchers. So they basically, it's a 1-2 punch. If you want this, you got to take this. There's always a string attached. And so all we could do is try to go to local city councils and just say, hey, I know you guys can't say much, but I want to be on record stating that this is happening. And then, you know, I've had people go and attack me because I've made statements or whatever, blah, 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 or I've done, you know, horrendous displays by unfurling a Confederate flag at a school board meeting when I was trying to protest they were trying to stop a Constitution class from taking place because one of the members that does it was a member of the League of the South. I mean, so what? And I was like, look, to most people, this means heritage, not hate. And again, I you could hear the ignorant people in the audience just clamoring for my head on a spike. But I mean, the point was, is people kind of look at it and go, oh, you did this, you did that, blah, blah, blah. But then I may not have been able to express exactly what I was trying to convey. But now you can look back and make it say, you know what? Sonny had a point there. Well, it's a little late to be acknowledging what I was trying to say now, because guess what? You just had three more families moving down the street on you, and you're starting to see all these cars parked in front of the houses. They're starting to have parties on the weekends and stuff. And next thing you know, guess what? Little Susie's tricycle's down the street just got stolen, or someone's car got broken into, or, oh, you heard of a drug bust that's not even three blocks from your house. Okay? That's how it starts. And the fact that you're a white person even mentioning these observations, you're automatically seen as a racist. You're automatically seen as a hater, or if you speak out about it, against it, you're a Nazi. So, I mean, that's how they get you, is try to strangulate you with a war on words, saying basically, take this castor oil, because we're going to shove it down your throat whether you like it or not.
Mm. Yeah, so in regards to, like, nationalist movements and the white nationalist movement, I know you've been getting into it very much lately, so... What are your solutions there, you think? What do you see developing?
Well, I was there in Charlottesville, Andreas, and I filmed that whole thing. And some of my footage has shown up on NSM's one of the YouTube pages before it got, you know, shut down, at least to the point where it's restricted. And I still haven't put the whole footage out yet because of the fact that a couple of people was concerned if you do, it might create more problems. But it should have came out as soon as I had it done because, in fact, I think it was very relevant. But that being said, I was there, and I even saw known media, some independent, some national, that I had recognized. I may not know exactly where they're from, but I recognize their faces. But a lot of them were getting accosted by the left. No one on the right was doing anything wrong. We were just trying to freely assemble. And they shut that down because I think they were afraid was if the speeches were recorded That was the biggest problem because the message would have gotten out. Because I've actually done rallies when I had a Tea Party movement, and I had some speakers say, well, how many people do you expect at your rally? It doesn't matter. I have a video camera. So if I have 5 or 10, 15 people in the crowd, it doesn't matter because millions could watch this thing on YouTube for years to come. I tell bands the same thing. When you go play a gig, if there's only 50 people in the crowd, you play after 50,000. Because you don't know who's in that crowd. I mean, how many stories we heard where that artist's life was completely changed because someone noticed them in the crowd or someone who had some acknowledgement in the industry or whatever the case may be, recognize the talent or the serious potential of this individual or this band, gave them the leg up that they needed, and now they're the superstars we know today. So, I mean, I always tell these people, you always act like there's a larger crowd than what's there because you don't know who's out there. I'm just a local guy who did promotions for bands and passionate about it. Can imagine if I was an A&R person and just so happened to walk into your gig. I mean, look at Linkin Park. Their first gig they played, there was an A&R guy out there who signed them on the spot. Hmm. Boom. Now in Linkin Park, it was a major commercial success, you know. But that's because one person who had some influence was in the crowd. Danny Sugarman, who was a longtime fan of the Doors. I think he actually ended up managing the band at one particular point or something like that. You know, he was just a kid in a crowd that saw the damn band, loved them, and documented the band extensively during his lifetime. So, I mean, again, all it takes is one person to have passion to do that. But what I'm seeing is after Charlottesville, everything went south, and I think the biggest problem is the racketeering. They've cut off our funding. We can't get any things. If they do anything they don't like, they go and they bitch to whoever you may be connected to. They try to get you fired from your jobs. They try to do all this stuff. They make it almost impossible for you to function or flourish. I mean, look at the war on Alex Jones. I mean, George Soros goes and buys PayPal and then cuts off Alex Jones from using PayPal. I mean, the stuff that these banks are doing right now, I mean, the NRA has probably got the most money coming into it in the existence of its organization. And they can't even process 50% of the revenue because most of these banks and stuff refuse to process because they're seen as a hate group now. They're not a hate group. They're probably more patriotic than any other group within the United States.
Mm. That's crazy. That's yeah, that is crazy. Yeah, we've also been victims to early victims to the PayPal ban and, you know, had all kinds of assets frozen, basically. I don't even know if we've seen them yet, but, you know, promised to pay it back within 6 months or so. And then the banks in Sweden has shut down our bank accounts. And where is that money going to be sent then? You know, once we get it back, we have attacks on all fronts, and they know that economically it's their ball game. You know, it's their rules. They know how to run that gambit, and also through the taxes. Now the tax office are on our case for not being able to process things through an official bank account because we were banned from the bank. Money had to be put in other accounts, and now these people are being hunted by the tax office. So they try all their little tactics to break us down, but you just have to stay strong and encourage people that have the tenacity and the capabilities to create our own solutions so that we can actually grow and not depend on the enemy's tools in order to succeed. Because it's never going to work like that. They're always going to use it against you. And the same goes for YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook, you know. You're never going to make it, you know. It's their ball court.
Well, you know, what's interesting is I've noticed, and you and I talked before about the fact that you started waking up and you started to understand the Fed. Mm-hmm. You have an apparatus that basically controls boom and bust cycles of the economy. That's actually how the enemy acquires all the territories, because they'll go and things will get good. There's a boom and people start spending money, building stuff up and making their things doing good. And as soon as things go bad, things get hard. And the next thing you know, someone comes in flush with cash and they buy out your entity and you become a subsidiary or affiliate of something else now, and they dictate what you can do. So not only do they do that, which is almost kind of like a hostile takeover through economic means, but now they build up an apparatus off of your blood, sweat, and tears. I mean, you go and build a business, you make a product, it becomes, I wouldn't say, like Kleenex is the generic term for facial tissue. Next thing you know, you have a bust cycle, and then Kleenex is really hurting for money. You go in and buy them out. Bam, you own Kleenex. Mm. And so you start seeing all this stuff going on, and then we're starting to find out how much the Jews really own. I mean, some of the products you buy, you need to look, because there's some of they're kosher certified or anything like that. Plus the fact that you had brought up on a show not too long ago about the 729 prefix code on the barcodes, which the barcode was started by Jews, by the way. But the 729, anything that product being 729 goes straight to Israel. So people are using consumerism as the new fascism to be able to go and fund these things. Besides taking your tax money, they're taking your sales money, because whoever owns these entities like Nestle and all this other stuff, they own all these major corporations who have buy up all these companies, and they have them all under their umbrella. Well, who owns the umbrella? You know, that's the first question. I mean, you always got to follow the money, because once you start following the money, then you start to see who the big fat cats are. And they start controlling who your politicians are. So it becomes Tammany Hall on a global scale. So, I mean, it's a very disturbing thing that's going on. And the fact that Hillary Clinton said the other day that you guys need to start looking at your migration policy because it's fueling your far-right extremist groups, to me is the most chaotic and idiotic thing that's come out of her mouth, because not only does she realizes what is starting the issue, but you know, with history, when things start going bad, people start eventually looking at the extremist elements. I mean, as much as we've been told that the Hitler of Hollywood is the Antichrist, why would Hitler even be an option? Well, look at the Weimar Republic by 1930-31, after the economic crash in 1929. Hitler was seen as a lot more an ideologue that they should want to follow, because the Democratic parties had no offers. The Communist Party just wanted complete total control. Nobody wants to look like Bolshevik Russia. Well, what options do you have? Well, you got a guy out there saying, hey, we all need to be one people and we can get this thing. We can whip it if we all bind together. I mean, how is that extreme? All because of the fact that they don't control the money. They don't control all the products and they don't have their hand in your pocket. Oh, that's what makes it extreme. And so that's why I mentioned that the Jews fear a neo-pagan renaissance more than anything else right now, because it's completely organic and cannot be commandeered. And that's why they are really fearful of a neo-pagan renaissance, which I think NRM also helps underscore a little bit, is not only do you have a more of a national socialist ideologue, but the fact that you are embracing your Nordic roots, and that you're showcasing, we used to be conquerors. Why are we allowing ourselves to be conquered? It should be the other way around. And I think you guys, that's why you guys are a threat, because of the fact that you're able to not only look good, puff your chest up and bow up when necessary, but you can throw down when you have to too. Like I talked to you about the one tall guy from NRM that was up there chasing all these SJWs away just because he got out of the car and chased them. They ran like a bunch of chickens. Yeah. That's one guy, dude. When you've got a whole legion of you guys walking down the street looking good, flags flying, and you guys are playing by the rules, they are scared shitless of you. And I think that's the type of imagery we need over here.
Yeah, and I do think so, too. I do think that, well, first off, you have to figure out who you are. You know, are you white? What kind of white are you? What kind of group are you? And how are we going to unite? But you have to do it, like you've been saying, you have to do it on the streets. You have to do it with people. You have to talk to people in real life. The revolution is not going to happen in cyberspace, because it's in many ways only artificial, you know. All these videos and all these memes.
You don't win revolutions by memeing. I mean, and that's another thing. The EU is trying to ban memes because they are effective. And the right-wing memes are the ones that are affected the most. Left-wing just doesn't get it because they really don't have a sense of humor. Yeah. Right-wing does. When you can take someone's own shit and throw it right back at them, and you got a screenshot of a famous film or an actor doing a facial expression, and it totally – even Gene Wilder with the Willy Wonka kind of like, duh, you know, and you put the meme up there, which makes people kind of go, well, yeah, duh. I mean, it's very effective. And when you can also have excellent propaganda films, like, again, your supporter there does stuff for Nordic Resistance Movement, it really goes, wow, man, something is happening. I mean, you cannot deny it. When you see an alternative for Deutschland, you see Golden Dawn, you see National Front, you see all these right-wing-based groups, and many of them are still controlled opposition, mind you. Some of them are still controlled. But when you start to see these things and are starting to get more people starting to side with them because, like, this is the alternative, man, we got to go this route. That, you know, like, it's kind of like Jim Morrison saying, that may have the guns, but we got the numbers. The fact that you guys have been disarmed and all you've got is basically your pride and a flag in your arm. Hey, man. If that's all you got, make it work.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. So, yeah, I was going to wrap this conversation up a little bit in a smooth way, but do you have anything, any last words you want to say to the listeners before we say thank you for this time?
A couple of things. I mean, like I said, I really enjoy your program. When I first came across it, I immediately was trying, as soon as I got a hold of you and figured out how to download it, I immediately added it to our lineup because of the fact that I really liked what I heard. You guys have a very good way of getting things on. You also got good guests on. You talk about not just issues involving Scandinavian and Nordic countries, but also all around. You're not afraid to mince words when necessary. You speak your mind. And also, you gave us a little inside baseball, what you're doing there with Nordic Resistance Movement. So I really think your program really shines on many different things. You are a beacon of hope for many other right-wing groups, not only in Europa, but also here in the States. And the fact that you guys are well-organized, you have excellent optics, and you go out there, it not only inspires other groups, but when you see movements in Poland following some of your similar cues and other people speaking up, and the fact that you've actually got national leaders like Viktor Orban stepping up and says, we need to have more babies. I mean, you got Putin has a sanctioned a family flag with the nuclear family on it with mother, father, you know, boy and girl. That says a lot, man. I mean, it's happening. And then you start listening to the mainstream media and go, why do you guys hate Putin so much? Why do you hate Orban? Why do you hate Nordic Resistance Movement? Not only are they effective, they're doing what's right, and they won't back down. And people will always respect strength over anything else, man. And like George Washington said here, to secure for peace is to prepare for war. And so I think when people have that basic mentality, even your preppers, making sure they have enough food supply and ammunition, and having like Billy Roper here with the Shield Wall Network, making sure you have people and resources within one tank of gas that if shit hits the fan, you can get to and you can coagulate together as a combined unit, may mean the detriment of survival or starvation. So I think when people start thinking of these alternate plans and plan B as well as plan C, it gives them more confidence in themselves because they know if things start to go bad pretty quickly, whether it's an EMP attack or financial collapse or whatever the case may be, you see these Black Friday videos where people are busting into Walmart over some stupid televisions. What are they going to do when they start running out of food, man?
Yeah,
it's going to be complete chaos. And so I think what you guys have really symbolized over there is that you can play by the rules, you're effective, your leaders speak well, they don't back down, they're not afraid to mince words, and you've got multiple programs to give different points of view. You have an English program so more of the Western world can listen in. And the fact that in your case, you guys play some interesting music. So, I mean, you really showcase a lot of what Scandinavia really should be. And I think if you grab the proverbial bull by the horns, man, you guys are going to win. You just got to reverse that BS that happened over there in Finland, man, and get Nordic Resistance Movement back on its feet. Because of the fact that I think once you get all the Nordic countries and have a presence with Nordfront on every one of them, you guys are a force to be reckoned with, and they will respect you because they know they can't beat you. They might try to outsmart you, but they know they can't beat you because they know you guys are a united front.
Mm. Nice. Very kind words. Well, I thank you for coming on. It's been a very nice conversation this evening. And I also thank the listeners for listening. You can catch the Nordic Frontier every Nordic Tuesday. That is Tuesday at 8 o'clock Nordic time. So, until next time, I say... Hail victory.
Hail victory.
I stood with the 300 against the invading horde. At the pass of Thermopylae, I died by the sword. On my shield I left with all my mortal might. Now into the fields of Elysium, my hero's afterlife. Killing fields of free men, dying for the
You're listening to Resolution Radio. Radio. ResolutionRDO.com.
My brothers, my sisters, I bring you a message of solidarity, a call to action, and a demand for adherence to duty of an Aryan resurgence and ultimately total Aryan victory. We have broken the chains of Jewish thought. We know not the meaning of the word mine, it is ours. Our race, the totality of our people. 10 hearts, one beat. 100 hearts, one beat. 10,000 hearts, one beat. We are born to fight and to die and to continue the flow. The flow of our people. Onward we will go, onward to the stars, high above the mud of yellow, black, and brown. So kinsmen, duty calls. The future is now. If months from now you have not yet fully committed yourself to the alliance, then you have in effect not only betrayed your race, you have betrayed yourself. So stand up like men and drive the enemy into the sea. Stand up like men and swear a sacred oath upon the green graves of our sires that you will reclaim what our forefathers discovered, explored, conquered, settled, built, and died for. Stand up like men and reclaim our soil. Kinsmen, arise. Look towards the stars and proclaim our destiny. Defeat never, victory forever.